You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
According to pollster and political strategist Mark Penn, many of the biggest movements in America today are small, and identifying those small movements is the key to understanding where the world is headed. Mr. Penn is the worldwide CEO of the public relations firm Burson Marsteller, president of the polling firm Penn, Schoen, and Berland Associates, and he's the author, with E. Kinney Zalesny, of Microtrends, the Small Forces Behind Tomorrow's Big Changes. It's just been released in a paperback edition by 12, and I'm pleased that it brings Mark Penn back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
When we're talking about a microtrend, how many people does a microtrend need to attract before it can wield influence in our culture?
Well, we technically defined a microtrend in the book as once things reach about 1%, once you have 1% or 3 million people who have an interest or part of a religion, a movement. I mean, there were just several million donors to politics for almost the very first time this election cycle, and you could see what a tremendous difference a microtrend like giving small political dollars, the kind of impact a microtrend like that can have. And most importantly, microtrends don't have to grow and become 50% of the population or reach tipping points. Just the fact that they exist at a significant enough level to have impact, influence, and today, frankly, if 1% bought microtrends, it would be a huge success. So 1% is a huge success for a product, for a car, for a book, for so many things out there.
Although sometimes it can also seem overblown. For example, swine flu has been blown up to be a bigger threat than it is, at least as far as I can tell.
Well, I don't know whether or not I'd call that a microtrend or not. Obviously, people were worried that it was going to be, much more than that, and to have a really possible significant influence. But that's not something that people choose. I think microtrends are really about, the kinds of choices people make, the kinds of things that are happening out there. You know, particularly the financial crisis. I always point out, if you think about it, all of this leverage was built on the subprime mortgage market, which was 10% of the mortgage market.
So that was a big microtrend.
Well, it reached a 17% default rate. So only 1.7% of the mortgages default really triggered the rest of it. So it's an example about how it was really a microtrend, hard to find among all that's going on, that really was at the rock bottom of the financial crisis. So these trends can be powerful. This definition we give, we don't fully stick to that as an ironclad rule, but we give it as a kind of rule of thumb, and it has to be something that we see really increasing in society rather than remaining static.
In your introduction, you write that in America, the Starbucks economy is triumphing over the Ford economy. What do you mean by that? Have you heard about Starbucks recently unbranding itself?
Well, the whole notion that Henry Ford had was that through mass production, he was going to bring down the cost of things so that everybody could afford them. And so his rule was you could have the Model T in any color you wanted as long as it was black. And that was really what the Ford economy was about and what people predicted. Yeah, as we would grow to hundreds of millions of people, as countries like China would grow to billions of people, that everybody would have to, by necessity, dress, look, and be the same. And instead, quite the opposite happened. We're in a Starbucks economy where personalization, I think, is much more the rule. People want to be different. The internet allows us to draw together people of so many different communities now, at the same time, much more efficiently than we ever could. And on top of that, I think you're seeing the means of production and personalizing something becoming far, far cheaper. So that, you take, interestingly, something like ordering a cup of coffee now, there are 155 different choices of coffee with the mocha, frappuccino, decaf, grande. Or you take a look at something like the Apple iPod. That was, for a while, any color you want as long as it was white. They've changed that. But in principle, they manufacture a standardized device, but you customized it into a jazz iPod, a rock iPod, you know, the Mark Penn iPod, so that you did the labor and the work, but the result were products of extremely interesting customization and personalization. And that is actually how the economy has moved.
But do you think that we go back and forth? For example, you mentioned Starbucks. There were complaints that all the Starbucks stores started looking alike. And as I just said, they've started unbranding themselves. According to the Seattle Times, the chain is opening pilot stores that lack the Starbucks name and are modeled to look like non-corporate community coffee shops.
Well, I think, you know, then the issues that Starbucks had as they matured, which I think is very different than as they were coming up. And I always talk about the kind of stages that companies have, that they, in the first stage, everything they do is right. They really, everything is heralded as unbelievable genius. And then in the second stage, they start to have problems where a lot of the ops happens. I think with Starbucks, and I did a Microtrends column in the Wall Street Journal on this called Value is the New Green, a lot of companies like Starbucks put everything on creating a unique and branded experience for which they also were able to charge a lot more. And with McDonald's coming in and becoming really the big competitor to Starbucks, which very few people expected, some people said, look, you know, skip the experience. I'll just take the coffee and I'll take it at a lower price. And so some of the experience marketers are suffering against value marketers in the time of recession. And I think that's probably the biggest microtrend, the importance of value in this economy and not just the most expensive, best experience you can buy.
There's also Dunkin' Donuts going after them. But it is interesting that with all those different choices, in the end, you're still buying Starbucks coffee. And the same sort of things people have pointed out, you go to the supermarket and there are lots of different cereals more than ever, and yet they're pretty much produced by the same two or three global food conglomerates and are just variants on the same basic ideas with varying amounts of sugar and chocolate and some other stuff added.
Well, look, if the Boston Tea Party were held today, I'm sure it wouldn't be just Earl Grey being dumped overboard. It would probably be 20 or 30 different teas. I mean, it is a society where product differentiation has been taken to new limits, and I think that's been a benefit. But the benefits of microtrends are just not in products. They're in lifestyle. There are new ways people live. There are new ways that people work. There are new religions that people take on. I think that it's so much broader than the product space, but I think in the product space it is a renewed world of choice, but those worlds of choice reflect, I think, the new kinds of choices people are making in their daily lives.
I'm talking to Mark J. Penn, who with E. Kinney Zelesny has written Microtrends, the Small Forces Behind Tomorrow's Big Changes, which is published by 12 in a revised and updated edition. And that's because the economy has taken a dramatic downturn since Microtrends was first published?
Well, I think that as we published it, of course, new trends are always happening. So I try to keep it current. And then I try in the Wall Street Journal online column to also kind of go through new things that are happening. But I think that the financial crisis created a series of new trends. And we started off talking about the new mattress stuffers. Suddenly, a lot of people were buying gold coins. They were buying safes. They were buying guns. They were sticking them all together, you know, somewhere in their house. I mean, I think that you really had both really people responding with some high degree of fear, as people had in the Depression. And then you saw bigger behavior changes, like people using credit cards less and cash more and actually reducing credit card debt and saving in a recession, which is really a surprise response. But we've seen a whole host of new things happen that we cover in the paperback edition. Everything from really the 1.6 million people that unexpectedly wind up working for the government and are new government workers, to the kind of layoffs I think we're seeing for the first time among professionals like lawyers who never experienced something like this.
Now, you mentioned that personal savings rate is increasing. It did the same thing during the Depression. Is history a good guide to identifying microtrends?
History can be a good guide, but But I do think a lot of the microtrends that you see are kind of new responses to situations that frankly didn't happen before. I try, particularly in the book, to talk about things that I think are less expected, you know, whether it's about teenage knitters, you know, really taking off as an interesting phenomenon of people wanting to make something with their hands, or in the trends to really kind of look at things that are new. Take a look at something like internet marriage. I don't think there's ever been a historical analog to the fact that 1 in 10 marriages now meet on the internet and cross all the social, cultural, religious boundaries that usually made the choice that someone had for marriage far more limited than it is today. So I think sometimes, particularly with the depression, you know, and current situation analogy, there are things that come out of history, but there are just so many new things in everyday life that have never been experienced before, that's where you can find a lot of the microtrends in this book.
And people sometimes are afraid to try new things. Healthcare, for example, at the top of the political agenda in Washington right now. Congress has been having a rough time coming up with any consensus on what to do, despite widespread agreement that the current situation is untenable. How do you think the administration has handled its case of health care reform so far? And how would you advise the president to go forward?
Well, this is a very, very difficult problem, because although everybody agrees that there should be change, very few people agree on exactly what that change should be, and even fewer people agree on how to pay for it. And I think that the heart of the problem is not about ideology or philosophy. It really is that if you have a system that covers roughly 85% of the country and you want to cover the next 15%, then to cover the next 15% is going to cost you, on a 10-year basis, between $1 and $2 trillion. And so the question is, who's going to pay that? Is it going to come from doctors? Is it going to come from hospitals? Is it going to come from insurance companies? Is it going to come from taxes on higher income? Is it going to come from the people who receive services? I think that also people are looking for cost controls and they're looking for quality controls. The other problem here is that the 85% that has coverage says, you know, it may not be perfect, but it could be very easy here to make my coverage worse in trying to get coverage to the last 15%. And so I'm going to look at this program very carefully to see if that's going to happen.
It's really weird, because when we're not debating this, people are always complaining about how the HMOs are denying them coverage, how the situation is really awful. And then suddenly when changes is suggested, then the system looks a lot better to them.
Well, and remember, they love their doctors, and many people like their own medical care. In microtrends, I've got the trend of what I call DIYDers, or do-it-yourself doctors, and people today look up a lot of their own healthcare issues first, and they show up at the doctor with the treatment and the drugs that they would like prescribed. So there are certainly a lot of changes, but there are a lot of changes to be made within the healthcare profession, like electronic medical records. You would think something as basic as dealing with records through the medical system on a simplified, electronic, cost-effective basis with tremendous savings is something that we would have been able to achieve over the last 10 years instead of almost having to start from scratch on that.
In your July 16th column for the Wall Street Journal, you wrote on the difference between elite Americans and everyone else. And you said, elites are actually more swayed by brands, both in politics and the marketplace. They're more likely to say that a presidential candidate's character or personality is of greater importance than his or her stand on the issues. How big a factor do you think that was in the last election?
Well, I've been observing this trend, and I have a chapter in Microtrends on impressionable elites. And the Aspen Elite Survey, I think, tended to reinforce the idea that elites, you know, very highly educated, are so busy today that in many ways they will, instead of get down to a lot of the facts and information, they will in fact kind of follow other elites in terms of what their opinion is or what they hear. You could look at the Bernie Madoff, you know, scandal. Madoff really knew how to manipulate elites precisely on the notion that people didn't really look at the statements, that they really listened to what other people at the country club had to say. And that's what he was actually able to capitalize. So this is a worrisome trend, whereas working and middle-class voters, people, I think that they have, you know, higher education, more access to information, more familiarity now through the internet of being able to deal with large amounts of information, and money matters much more to them.
But the SEC was told about Bernard Madoff, and it ignored all of the warning signs. So why are you blaming the investors for putting their – you say the investors in these schemes were elites putting their money into a myth, never over a decade of investing, digging down to get the facts.
And I think that I'm not blaming. You have to blame Madoff. What I'm saying is he knew how to exploit elites and their heavy reliance on what other people have to say, and that they're increasingly other-directed nature as opposed to the people who buried deep into the statements and really said, you know, and walked away from the thing saying, you know, I'm not getting the information I need. And so Madoff is kind of an example of somebody who could exploit it. But the general trend is that people who are going for the more, you know, value-oriented, information-based shopping, and there are a lot of new information-based shoppers, are in many ways working in middle-class voters with new access to information. And elites tend to be now more swayed by brands, more swayed by what they see or hear on TV. And therefore, it's really quite an interesting reversal of what used to be the almost exactly the opposite case in America.
And so obviously, Bernard Madoff had good branding. But branding, since you are also very much a political animal, can we talk a bit about branding in politics? In an interview in the New York Observer in February 2008, you said of the presidential campaign, there was a misunderstanding that the Clinton campaign was about small things. It never was. If anything, the Obama campaign has micro-targeted constituencies. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that some people try to say, well, microtrends suggest that the world is only made of these microtrends, and it's not. And larger, big factors often result in a lot of microtrends, such as the financial crisis is one. You know, the movement of women in the workforce kicks off a lot of the microtrends. There are big forces or macro trends behind some of these. In the election campaign, Hillary stood for reform of health care, for, you know, basically recasting, you know, large swaths of American policy and how we would operate, you know, diplomacy, and how we would deal with Iraq. So her campaign was about big things and was also about reaching out to individuals. And just as the Barack Obama campaign was about big themes like change, he also had a director of micro-targeting and very carefully micro-targeted communities like college students and had, you know, clear micro-targeted proposals such as, you know, no income taxation for you know, certain segments of the senior population. Mm-hmm. So I think good campaigns have to have a set of big ideas. They have to have a set of concrete values, and in the field, they have to go down and appeal to the growing micro trends that there are in society. You've got to do all three.
Well, talking about volumes, The Atlantic magazine has posted a Clinton campaign strategy memo from 2007 in which you wrote, "I cannot imagine America electing a president during a time of war who's not at his center fundamentally American in his thinking and in his values." And then you went on to write, "Let's explicitly own American in our programs, the speeches and the values. He doesn't." So what was it about Barack Obama that led you to believe that he didn't have American values? Because you also wrote that he was unelectable against perhaps Attila the Hun, which may even be insulting to John McCain or maybe Sarah Palin. I'm not sure.
Well, look, it really wasn't that in any sense that he was un-American. He is American, and his story is a great one. He was at that moment in the campaign emphasizing a lot of his international international roots, and the memo doesn't suggest actually any kind of negative campaign against him. It suggests that she maybe remind people about where she's come from and a lot of her history that hadn't been known. But the truth is, I think that he has been coming out here an excellent president, an excellent leader for the country, taking the country and reversing a lot of the wrong directions that President Bush had been taking the country, and particularly the image of America with the team of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton has been doing a lot to reverse the problematic image that the country has had.
Well, you had to leave the Clinton campaign over controversy surrounding your companies connected with the government of Colombia. And you and your company, Burson Marcella, have been criticized for the clients that you've taken on. In March of this year, MSNBC's Rachel Maddow attacked your company for its client list, which included AIG. Maybe we could play a little clip.
Well, let me put it this way. When Blackwater killed those 17 Iraqi civilians in Baghdad, they called Burson Marsteller. When there was a nuclear meltdown at Three Mile Island, Babcock and Wilcox, who built that plant, called Burson Marsteller. The Bhopal chemical disaster that killed thousands of people in India, Union Carbide called Burson Marsteller. Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceausescu, Burson Marsteller. The government of Saudi Arabia, 3 days after 9/11, Burson Marsteller. The military junta that overthrew the government of Argentina in 1976, the generals dialed Burson Marsteller. The government of Indonesia, accused of genocide in East Timor, Burson Marsteller. The government of Nigeria, accused of genocide in Biafra, Burson Marsteller. Philip Morris, Burson Marsteller. Silicone breast implants, Burson Marsteller. The government of Colombia, trying to make all those dead union organizers not get in the way of a new trade deal, they called Burson Marsteller. Do you remember Aqua Dots? Little toy beads coated with something that turned into the date rape drug when kids put the beads in their mouths?
Now, I have to admit, most of those things happened before you joined the company in 2005.
That's correct. I joined the company actually in 2006. And but having said that, during this period, Burson Marsteller's probably had, they have about close to 1,500 clients a year. So they have a tremendous client base, and they do get called from people who are in crisis. And they should never confirm or confuse public relations representation, according to a very strict code of ethics that we enforce. About both us and clients being honest about what they're doing. Never confuse that with the actual deeds or misdeeds of clients. I mean, any more than you'd confuse that with the lawyers who are working with clients. So the firm provides communications help for people, for some of the greatest brands, some of the biggest NGOs and others, and also people who hit a crisis and need communications help and are willing to work within the ethical constraints of that. And some of these things, look, I was in the political campaign, so take something like Blackwater, where someone who worked over in Iraq assisted people for a single interview and actually never became an official client beyond that several days of help that someone gave who had served for 6 months in Iraq, and a lot of things got mixed in the what I'd say in the stew of politics. Of course, I continued on with the Clinton campaign through to the end, but politics, I think, can particularly bring in these issues, but it shouldn't be confused with the fact that, Burson Marsteller has 2,000 great professionals who work according to a rigorous code of ethics for literally thousands of clients, and the same kind of list could basically be pulled up on every single major public relations firm that works for some of the greatest names you've ever heard and some of the most difficult names you've also heard, because just as you would find out with any law firm, serving those people with both who do great deeds and clients that get in trouble is part of the profession.
Mark J. Penn.
And will be for thousands of years.
Mark J. Penn is the worldwide CEO of the public relations firm Burson Marsteller, also president of the polling firm Penn, Schoen, and Berland Associates, author with E. Kinney Zalesny of Microtrends, The Small Forces Behind Tomorrow's Big Changes, which is published by 12, an interesting publishing company because it only publishes one book a month, therefore its name 12. And the new revised and updated edition of Microtrends, which was a New York Times bestseller, has just been released by 12. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Very much enjoying it.